Very wonderful for me to be here. First of all, it's a great opportunity to sit with a group, especially on days like today when I and a few other people are exhausted and can't help but notice that every time that I sit, especially when I have a dedicated sitting and then a responsibility, I seem to just get energy. It seems like I get connected to some kind of a tube that energizes me and puts this little smile on my face. And so I always appreciate the opportunity to do that. On my way driving here, I was driving up Gough and taking in the sights of the city because I live across the bay. And I noticed this tiny little car. You know, one of those little cars that looks like a motorcycle with a hoodie. Parking in the only space that would suit that little car. No other car could ever fit in that. And my intention tonight was to talk about vulnerability. But I didn't know how I was going to begin. And so I was leaving it up to the fates and synchronicity. And that was the reason that I saw that little yellow and black motorcycle with a hoodie car. It gave me my opening line, which is, what is the vehicle that you are moving through life with? Is it that little motorcycle with the hoodie? Is it that big, powerful, indomitable, untouchable 4x4? Is it a bicycle? Or do you walk step by step? How do we move through life and how do we arrange our external definitions in such a way that we feel protected, that we feel defined, that we feel untouchable? And how does that untouchability actually restrict our capacity to be fully present, fully mindful with each breath, ready to take on whatever it is that meets us without preparation, without a particular role, without the fear and anxiety of what the image is that we are going to present in the other person's mind? When we walk down a street, are we dog walkers? Are we the person who carries the yoga mat in those fancy little things that you put on your shoulder? Are we the person that's in a hurry because we're important and there are things to do and people need us? Are we the person that kind of lollygags and has all the time in the world? Are we concerned about how other people see us? Are we looking at others? What are the roles that become the vehicles that we move through life in? Are we an expert at something? Are we mothers? Are we teachers? Are we students? Even if at various times we take on those different roles, what would happen if we were to drop them for a moment? Get out of our vehicle. Take off our shoes and be barefoot, step by step, breath by breath, on the path of just being without being me, whatever that me is, from moment to moment. So how does this relate to vulnerability? And I know last week, because I heard it, Howie's talk, he did touch on a point of vulnerability. He was talking about his wife, and she had a back problem and a long recovery, and how being embodied in this state that we call being alive, we are very, very vulnerable. We can't help but be vulnerable. We wear clothes to be warm. We go to the doctor, we eat healthy food. We make sure that we get enough sleep. But we are still, by essence and definition of being embodied, vulnerable to what Shakespeare would call the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. So that's a level of vulnerability which is very real. But it's pointing towards the vulnerability of suffering and of pain, which of course is imminently, momentously real for us. But I would like to shade this concept, this word, this experience, vulnerability, slightly different tonight, and suggest that when we drop the roles, when we drop trying to control how other people see us and relate to us, when we drop using all of our infinite intelligence and imagination and talents to control what goes on for us from moment to moment, we actually move into the essential spiritual question: who are we? And when we reflect on that essential question, we can't help but drop into a state of quiet, a deeper state of experience. You could say we immediately become a little more mindful. And when we are completely dedicated to that question, immersed in that question, and every response and answer that arises we realize is not really profound enough, it's not really essential enough, it's not really who we truly are, then we touch in that place of vulnerability where we are not defended. Or as the psychologists say, we're not armored. We're not informed by the stories that we think define our past experiences. And we're not agitated by the things that we anticipate happening in the future. And we're not strategizing between those two poles 24/7, wearying our bodies and our minds in the attempt. We simply are. And it's an extraordinary thing to not be defined for just a second. It's the actual profound moment of genuine creativity to not be defined, because then everything is possible. Then we live in the essence of what brings us to practice and what we experience every time that we sit to meditate, which is that we don't know, we can't anticipate what is going to happen. And that is the beauty. You know, you might be coming to Julian Street and thinking, oh, last week, boy, my knee was really sore. I bet it's going to happen again tonight. And if it does, I'll let myself move. Or not. But the funny thing about moving when you're meditating with other people is that that definitive, that defense, that guard that we have about how other people experience us gets quite activated in something very, very, very simple like, oh my God, my knee is killing me. How can I move it so that nobody hears or notices? Because I want to protect my image in other people's minds that I am a great and dedicated and achieved meditator. So already there's that little defense, that little control, that little definition. And you know, it's really incredibly difficult, soul-destroying work, literally, soul-destroying work, to constantly have to be juggling how we see ourselves and how we manage how other people see us. I mean, it's a full-time thing. And if you really, really are honest with yourself and practice mindfulness in your moment-to-moment life, in the world of work, in the world of relationships, in the world of walking through the street or driving on the highways, you realize, listening to your mind, that most of the time that's what our thoughts are about. How do I see myself? How do other people define me? And what can I do to change it? Or keep it? He told me he loved me. I wonder how he'll feel tomorrow. They said, I'm brilliant. What am I going to do tonight when I give a talk? Destroy the whole image. Okay. So it's the vulnerability that actually brings us to a place where we are willing to shed all those things, which begins with a very profound and essential question that arises in practice. Aside from who am I, how can I fully be present in not knowing? Or as somebody said, don't know mind. A wonderful Tibetan teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, once was asked, oh dear teacher, please tell us, what is enlightened mind? And Trungpa laughed for a second, as he always did. He's dead. He might be laughing still. Who am I to say? He said, enlightened mind is don't know mind. Can you imagine resting in a relaxed, spacious, open place with not knowing? Not predicting, not judging, not calculating, not rummaging through history to see what's likely and possible based on what has happened. Not thinking about what all the people said is true, not thinking about what the book said is true, just being able to say, oh, in this moment I'm completely open and I don't know what the next moment will hold. That's very vulnerable. But at the same time, because it is so steady, because when we are in that mindful, open, vulnerable state, there's such an extraordinary quiet inside. Because of that, our senses, our five senses that are completely important for our experience and for our survival, become more acute. We see more. We hear more. We feel more. Not only what is going on tactily on the surface of the skin, but what is going on inside our bodies. We smell, we taste more. So when we're in that state, we are actually in a heightened sensory experience where our senses are actually doing exactly what they're designed to do, inform us of this experience that we call being alive. There's nothing more thrilling. There is a Burmese tradition, and Burma, interestingly enough, even though it's been under terrible regimes for a long time, very repressive, has preserved, of all the countries in the world, all the Asian Buddhist countries in the world, no country has preserved the practice tradition in the monastic system as purely as Burma, because that was the one thing that this military government protected, was the monastic tradition and the monks' practice. Interesting. But I did some Burmese practice, and it's a very interesting practice, and it actually is all about experiencing the senses, nothing else. For 3 days in a 10-day retreat, traditionally the retreats were 10 days. That was the minimal. Now they're 6 days. We must be getting better. The first 3 days, we practice something called Anapanasati, which is a sensation of the air moving in and out of the nostril, just for the purpose of focusing, and getting a laser beam of attention. And for the next days, if there's three, then yes, for the next week, we were supposed to do something called sweeping. And I took this retreat with a man named Robert Hover, who actually was a NASA engineer. So there was no woo-woo about it, believe me. And when the Dharma talk came at 9 o'clock, you know, the 9 o'clock Dharma talk at the end of every practice day, he said, okay, we're not going to do Anapanasati anymore. We're going to do the graduated practice, which is called sweeping, and I would teach it to you tonight. And we thought, oh my God, we're going to do something new and different. Yay. So he started at the waist. And what we were supposed to do was imagine that across our entire body, wafer thin, like something that you put under a microscope, all that you were supposed to determine was where there was sensation and where there was numbness. And then go to the next layer. And go to the next layer. And he guided us through that. And it took about 2 hours and 15, 20 minutes to get to the toes. And we were blown away. And he said, next morning, this is what you're going to be doing every time that you sit. You start at the top of your head, and you're going to do this just in terms of sensation. And when you went in for an interview with the teacher, there was only one question. The teacher said, okay, where do you feel things? And where are you numb? And it really was quite amazing. Some people could feel their bones. Some people could feel the marrow in their bones. So, sensation, the acuity of the five senses, become sparkly, become clarified, become purified when we open ourselves up and dispense of our various wardrobes of identities, and the heaviness and the responsibility and the obligation that we feel moment to moment, having to support all those wardrobes of identities, and being vulnerable. Vulnerable as a form of awareness, as a form of stabilization, and as a form of the foundation of strength, not weakness. Now, there's a fabulous TED Talk, for any of you who listen to TED Talks, by a woman named Brené Brown, who made vulnerability a regular word in our society. It took a lot of courage, it took a lot of guts for her to just pitch into that and hallow it, hold it high as an empowered state, and invite people to just think about the possibility of being willing to be vulnerable. So she gave the TED Talk, and who would have thought, within a week, there were 15 million viewers across the world. That 15 million people within a week would respond to vulnerability. I mean, it blew my mind. Because most of the time when we hear vulnerable, it's like, ooh, no, that means I'm going to be, you know, attacked or abused, or I'm going to invite things that are destructive. No, that's not what I'm saying. Vulnerability as a form of empowerment, because it approaches the truth of what we are and what we confront from moment to moment. We cannot control all the factors that we will encounter in our lives. We can engage with them But the question is, what is wise engagement? Is it wise engagement to be ready, to be open, to trust that everything that we have experienced, everything that we have learned, everything that we have loved has accumulated, is all informed and operating? We don't have to remind ourselves of it all of the time. It is there in our hard drive. Everything that we present to ourselves and to the world from moment to moment includes everything that we have been from the moment we were born and before. So we don't have to become self-conscious. Let me see, do I remember this? Let me see, I really want to make sure that I get it right. Get it wrong. So one of the tests of being willing to be vulnerable and the openness and the relaxation and the relief that it can bring you is asking yourself, how easy is it for me to say, oh, I'm wrong, I got that wrong? Without feeling stupid, without feeling that you're offering people, you know, your heart in their hands, without the feeling that you're being foolish or weak. To coworkers, oh, I got that wrong. You're absolutely right. Thank you. To your significant other. To your children. To your students. How about when you're driving and you do make a mistake, you did cut somebody off, can you look at them comfortably and say, so sorry, while they're cursing you? But imagine the looseness, imagine the relaxation, if you did have that ease of being able to admit those things. The defenses are down, which means that you have all of your acuities, all of your senses. Everything that you have learned is more available to you. Because when we're contracted in control, we only have a percentage of everything that we are available to us to utilize and to be skillful with in the world. But when we give up that need to control, we actually have so much more access to everything that we are and all the resources that we have accumulated, the instincts, the intuitions. So it is actually a state of empowerment, and it is a state that approaches the perfection of human being, because we trust ourselves. Not foolishly, but confidently. We're looser. We have more fun. We get a sense of humor, and we can laugh more deeply when other people are funny. And the great thing about it is that it actually is a contact sport. The more relaxed and vulnerable and open and confident we are, without needing to assert who we are, the more other people kind of affiliate with that and feel more relaxed and open and vulnerable themselves. It might be the very secret to having a more joyous life with others. Probably the fundamental secret, maybe the only secret, for what it is to really be intimate, to really be able to be close, to really be able to have genuine contact, which begins with ourselves. Oh my God, it's 9:05. Okay, I wanted to give you guys a chance to talk about your experience of vulnerability. I think that's my talk. To give you a chance to horn in. That's my talk. So I welcome all comments, all any response, any unguarded or guarded, controlling or uncontrolling response that you want, and you don't have to appear enlightened. Nobody is judging you. And if they are, they will suffer it, not you. Your senses become more acute. You have much more of your... I know, because I work with neurologists now. You know, the whole neurology thing. It's absolutely true. In brain scans, it shows that when a person is in a relaxed and compassionate state, so much more of their memory banks are available to them. So much more of their language center is available to us. So much more of our prefrontal, our judging, our determining, our discerning. All of these things are shining and radiating much more distribution of energy than when we're in a contracted state of, oh my God, I've got to defend myself.
Well, that's what I was wondering, is like, if you're in, when you're open to that moment, how are you not judging? Like, how does the experience not become a judgment of, like, what's happening now? What's happening now? Like, you know? How do you know what's going on without judging it?
Judgment is absolutely not a way to determine what is true. Judgment is a coloring of the immediacy of what your senses are taking in. Judging is a very, very overused function for applying what we've learned in the past to what is in the present and forbidding the present to be something fresh and surprising. So it really guarantees that even though we're committed to changing and evolving, judging is one of the things that really becomes a heavy foot in that process. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah, I really, we don't have to believe neurologists, but we can certainly go based on our own experience. Is it true that when you're present and your mind is quiet, that you see more clearly, that you hear more sharply? Like right now at this moment, if your mind is quiet, you can hear that creaking chair. I know you're moving back there. And you are allowed to. So really, you know, our five senses are, it's kind of like they've been washed with the water of purification when our mind is not yabbering. And our five senses not only are precious for connecting us with this experience that we call being alive, but our five senses are our immediate defense against direct attack. Last year I went to one of those boutique goat farms and discovered that a third of the baby goats get culled so that there's more milk for production. I was so shocked that I immediately took two goats that were, I didn't immediately take them. They were one day old when I met them, and I thought, I'm not going to be impulsive. I'm going to think about this for 5 days. And 5 days later, I adopted them. And so I adopted two this year from the Petaluma Livestock Auction, because it's just a good thing to do in the spring, and I have little extra land. And then I have to find a home for them. And that's why I'm tired, because they're 12 weeks old yesterday, and they're ready to find a new home. You know, as somebody who, my thing is from loving hands to loving hands. So, you know, when I tell people about that, they say, oh, I love goats. But then the other thing that people will say is, but it's really strange looking in their eyes. Because their pupils go like this. So I thought, gee, you know, goats are so sweet and they're so innocent and they're such wonderful, charmed and charming characters. Why have they been associated with the devil and maligned for such a long time, aside from being bi-hoofed? It's that. It's a strange thing for us to see. But do you know why their pupils are elongated sideways like that? Because they are so vulnerable. They are such prey to so many things that having pupils that go sideways like this gives them extra depth in their peripheral perception. So they can see when something is coming at them. Our senses are designed for our survival. If we're lost in the stories that we're telling ourselves and creating anxiety inside of our bodies, our senses are operating at reduced capacity and our survival is reduced as well. That's why when we are in an accident or something really, really, really life-threatening is happening to us, the mind stops, time slows down, and we can remember every little decibel of experience because our senses are sharpened to support our survival. So, try it and see if I'm right. I could be really wrong. And if I am, I want you to tell me, and I will admit it. Okay, my dears, it's 9 o'clock. Just 2 minutes of sitting before we, just to collect it back. Okay. Thank you very much, and please let me know if you have any ideas of a loving home for Oscar and Olivia.
You know, know, Burl Heist was Goat Hill at one time.
There you go.